Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guests today are the psychiatrist, author and patron of the Society, Ian McGilchrist, and Robert M. Ellis, the chair of the Society. And the topic of their discussion will be dogma and the brain. The dialogue will be very much exploratory in nature, so we'll just see what happens. Anyway, a warm welcome back to you both to the MWS podcast.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Okay, well, maybe we could start with you, Robert. For example, what do you understand by dogma?
I'd understand dogma as a fixed position, a position which, well, in the end, I would understand as psychologically fixed. So it's not just a question of how that position is defined philosophically, but what its actual state is in the mind or the brain. So dogma, but obviously also I'm very interested in dogma also from a philosophical point of view and how that intersects with the psychology. So I also associate dogma, well, I see dogma as the psychological dimension of metaphysics, metaphysics being beliefs of a type that are not amenable to experience under absolute in nature, are not amenable to experience because they're absolute in nature, and thus beyond any possible criticism from experience. How would that fit with your view, Ian?
They depend on consistency with other propositions that one has already accepted as incontrovertible, or incontrovertible, I should say. Yes, is that right? So they gain their validity from simply following from other ones of the same kind. They have internal consistency, but cannot be validated one way or the other through experience.
Indeed, yes. So you could have a whole system of dogma. A system of metaphysics.
Plenty of people do.
Indeed. Yeah. So that's where I've been very interested in the way, well, I found your work very valuable in understanding dogma from a new perspective and its relationship with the dominant left hemisphere. And I don't know if you want to say how you understand that.
Well, yes. I mean, I think if there's a value to viewing these things from a point of view of the brain, it's because there are things that we can know about our experience and thought which are not actually knowable simply by introspection, because evolution has taken care that we shouldn't be aware of them. And one of these is that the two hemispheres of the brain have different ways of conceiving the world. This basically goes down to, as you know, their different attention to the world. And the left hemisphere, because I view it from a Darwinian perspective as the one that helps us to grab things, grasp them, take them, and this means food and other things that are needed quickly to manipulate the environment. It's got a kind of rather black and white view about things. It prizes certainty. The right hemisphere, from the same Darwinian perspective, is the one that is keeping a lookout for whatever else might be going on while you're grasping. And this is not just a helpful metaphor. It is grounded in the way in which animals, all those that we have studied, use the two halves of their brains in two ways. For having a narrow focused attention to something you want to grasp, and the other for having a broad vigilance. And if you are intent on grasping things, then you're more likely to be cut and dried and prize certainty. And Ramachandran calls the right hemisphere the devil's advocate, because it's always the one that's going, are you sure? Does this really accord with the rest of all that we can see? So on that basis alone, dogma is more something that is likely to be left hemisphere linked. But there are probably a couple of other things that make it so. The right hemisphere seems to be more in touch with embodied existence and to be less preoccupied with creating a system of abstract categories that systematically relate to one another. And it's also probably less abstract in the way it views things like belief. Belief can be simply viewed as a kind of feeble form of knowing, that you say, I believe something to be the case when you don't really know it. And if you could know for certain, you wouldn't have to use the word belief. But I take it that belief, indeed, in its etymology, means something to do with a relationship with another existing thing or state of affairs, which is, and it's the right hemisphere that enables us to relate to the world in more complex ways. And I think a third point would be the rather interesting reflection on this that the Deglin and Kinsborn experiment reveals. Deglin and Kinsborn did a marvelous experiment in which they, a beautifully devised experiment, in which they examined the nature of truth in each hemisphere. And they did this by presenting syllogisms and asking whether they were true or not. The catch in this was that the syllogisms had a true major premise and a blatantly false minor premise. And the question was, is the conclusion that is drawn from these premises true? Now, a syllogism, as you know, is of the form, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, it follows that Socrates is mortal. And in these cases, the second of these propositions happened to be false. So, for example, all monkeys climb trees, the porcupine is a monkey, the porcupine climbs trees. Clearly, the experience suggests that the porcupine is not a monkey, but the logic, internal logic of the system insists that, that the answer to this is true. And they gave these syllogisms to people in three conditions, one with the brain intact, one with the left hemisphere alone functioning, and one with the right hemisphere alone functioning. And essentially, in the intact state and the right hemisphere only condition, people said the conclusion was false because a porcupine wasn't a monkey. But in the left hemisphere only, the same individuals, not just aggregated data, but the very same people answered differently that the conclusion was correct. Even when challenged that is a porcupine a monkey, they said, well, I know it isn't, but nonetheless, the conclusion is correct because it follows from the internal logic of the system. Now, it took a little while to explain that, but I think if one has that in one's head, it explains wonderfully what I call the hall of mirrors, that the left hemisphere is concerned with constructing things that are consistent without necessarily referring to experience, whereas the right hemisphere is always testing things against experience.
Mm. I mean, what I find very interesting in your work in conjunction with that is the insight that also the left hemisphere doesn't really have a grasp of temporality, that it has, it can grasp sequence, but not temporality. So therefore, the left hemisphere may have certainty at certain points, but it doesn't recognize that it can change at other points, and that the nature of the or the representations of the left hemisphere are different at different times. And that, for me, is a sort of crucial element, I think, in understanding the possibility of integration, that these these cognitive models that we might, these representations that we might have, and that turn into dogmas, particular time, there's still the possibility that the right hemisphere might link them together, so that they can become integrated, so that we can make progress in understanding and overcoming the limitations of a particular dogma.
If something is true in this abstract sense, then it is true for all time. Perhaps I could just gloss the remark that the left hemisphere has no sense of time, because what you said was strictly correct, but it might be worth elaborating on that. Mm. It seems that, as you say, the right hemisphere understands a flow, and time is one of the things that flows, whereas the left hemisphere sees things as a succession of points, and it can therefore say whether something comes after something else in time at a point, but it can't, as it were, perceive the ever-evolving flux. And I suppose what you're saying is that all living things, including our thought processes about and experience of the living world are things that need to flow. And this comes down to that, you know, amusing thing of the Ship of Theseus paradox, or the growing paradox, that everything that living is constantly changing. Its form remains more or less the same, although that changes too, but the things that constitute it are constantly changing. So the left hemisphere, if it's changed, it's not the same thing, and it gets very hung up about that.
Yeah, or you can see that in Zeno's paradox as well, which I think is a wonderful example of the two different perspectives and how they don't match, that arrow never reaches its target, for example, because the left hemisphere, from the left hemisphere's point of view, that is, a particular time, because it just sees it as a set of sequences, as an infinitely divisible track in time and space. So, but I suppose that's what I find valuable here, again, is that if we can not just see this as, well, a problem, we tend to get into dogmatic states, but also there is also a solution here, or a potential solution, in the possibility of integration using the right hemisphere, which doesn't, a kind of solution that doesn't just appeal to the right hemisphere, but actually integrates the left hemisphere and its workings in a wider perspective.
Yes, indeed. And of course, that is one of the differences between the way in which the two hemispheres seem to relate, that both neuropsychologically and neurophysiologically, the left hemisphere tends to be more exclusive and the right hemisphere tends to be more inclusive. And it's trying to, as it were, synthesize the input from the left hemisphere with its own, whereas the left hemisphere is not capable of or involved in synthesizing the right hemisphere information into and altering its own perceptions. So, I mean, these are generalizations, but they have very broad validity. And I suppose the key there is that the right hemisphere is, as I say in the metaphor of the book, the master, the one that sees everything. And it literally is the hemisphere whose attention is to the whole picture, and is therefore, its task is to try and integrate what the left hemisphere knows into the whole picture. The question then is, how do we bypass a prejudice in our culture in which we prize logical consistency above everything, including truth to experience, so that we're constantly confronted by the most absurd things every day? I mean, we all comment on these. How can it be that when everybody knows that it's good for children to be allowed to play relatively freely and to accept a degree of risk, that our society is constantly closing down the ability for them to do this? Very few people think this is good, but we seem locked into a way of thinking and behaving that enforces this. It's just an example, but in the book I'm writing at the moment called The Porcupine is a Monkey, for reasons that you'll probably see, I'm looking at a whole range, you know, you can find them everywhere in daily life, where we know from experience that something is the case, but we carry on believing or pretending to believe something completely different. So how do we free ourselves from this?
Well, I suspect the issue is to do with, well, officially represented positions, almost, isn't it? That we nail ourselves to a particular representation, and then the left hemisphere then becomes dominant in, you know, we go back to that left hemisphere dominant way of representing things whenever that comes up again, such positions can also become politically entrenched. You know, they can be a matter of power and the repression of alternative perspectives. I mean, that again seems to you know, relates to my whole understanding of power, I think, and how power works. Anyway, go on.
Well, that's an interesting point. Perhaps we could explore that a bit. There's also the problem that we can't, it doesn't seem, oddly, although the right hemisphere knows more than the left and understands more than the left, left hemisphere modes are nowadays associated with intelligence. So just thinking in a purely abstract, logical way, in the way that a computer might generate a solution, is identified with having intelligence, and that other considerations are somehow dismissed as folk psychology or intuition, that is the fallible, of course, as we know, being a rational calculating machine makes you very vulnerable and deluded as well, but that's not taken into account. So we have that problem as well, that if you want to seem bright, you don't espouse positions that can't be rationally defended according to the current dogma.
Yeah.
It takes a degree of boldness for anyone in the academic sphere to stand out and say, but this isn't what the world is like.
Yep. But there are various strands that can be drawn together. You know, if you take recent work on cognitive biases and on embodied meaning, for example, I think all of these can potentially support a wider perspective in which this kind of approach is challenged.
You're thinking perhaps of the sort of challenge posed by Lakoff and Johnson versus Tversky and Kahneman, that sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, not necessarily versus Kahneman, but they're perhaps separate contributions which need bringing together rather than opposing
to
each other.
I'm not meaning to dismiss the very interesting work of Kahneman and Tversky, but it does seem to be particularly Tversky was rather unaware, if you like, it's all got the same perspective, that you're on the inside because you see cleverly that human beings are not making wrong decisions. But some of those wrong decisions, when seen in embodied context, they're the price that's paid for seeing something else that elsewhere in the system pays off.
Yeah. Well, that seems tied to the whole idea that the problem is one of rationality, doesn't it? Which,
yes.
I mean, I think it'd be better to think a bit differently from that, that cognitive biases are much more about a lack of objectivity in a broader sense, so lack of awareness and, sufficient connectivity to the right hemisphere and the awareness it can bring to our experience.
How does one argue that? Because one does, I mean, neither you nor I, who've spent a lot of time using reason to come to our conclusions, want to be in any way denigrating the enormous power of reason. But I suppose it's alerting people to the limitations, and that's what I see myself quite a lot of the time.
Indeed, but I think it's just that reason, it's a connector. It connects premises to conclusions, so it's just a mechanism in that sense. You have to be able to fit the pieces together. You obviously need the pieces in order to fit them together. So you can't have a jigsaw without the pieces. You couldn't have any kind of representation of anything without the left hemisphere producing those representations. But at the same time, each of the pieces of the jigsaw, gives you very little perspective on the whole picture. That's where I'd say that objectivity consists in fitting the jigsaw together, fitting these different representations of the left hemisphere together at different points, not just logically, but also more broadly through integration.
And seeing perhaps different pieces, because the pieces of the jigsaw, to use this analogy, are seen as fixed and given, but of course they never are.
Indeed, yeah. If we don't know what they are, then we've got to be open in our perspectives in order to.
And sometimes this can be down to quite simple things, like the data being nothing like as reliable as they look when you look at the reasoning behind certain rather broad conclusions.
I mean, that's why I think we need to reconsider our attitude to justification, that justification of a particular belief should not just be a matter of, coherence either with other beliefs that we already hold or with evidence, but also it needs to have an element of recognition of limitations, if we can bring together use of evidence and coherence with a recognition that we don't have the full picture and bring that in as well, then there's much more chance that the beliefs are being considered in a more provisional, integrated state in which other possible pieces that should be fitted into the jigsaw can be considered.
Yes, I'd agree with
you. I suppose for me, it's this kind of pervasive idea that the alternative to dogma is rationality. And it doesn't seem to me obvious that that's the best way of thinking about it. If rationality, there are obviously a number of different kinds of theories of rationality, which are refinements of just the idea of logic and reasoning. But if our, you know, if our use of the word to me suggests that we're expecting the alternative to dogma to in some way be using reason more effectively rather than openness to experience beyond that mere coherence, maybe dogmatic coherence or deluded coherence. So,
yeah, because that rationalizing can become dogmatic too. It can be a tool for escaping dogma, but it can be a tool for entrenching dogma.
Indeed.
Because as you say, you just have a consistent body of beliefs without examining them in relation to experience to a satisfactory degree. And opening oneself, as you say, to experience. The trouble with this is that we all think we know what experience is, but of course we only have our own experience, which is based on the way we have experienced things in the past. So we don't know what it is our experience is excluding. So it behoves us always to be open to the possibility of things that we can't know.
Yeah, but that's where provisionality comes in. And really, I don't find much discussion of provisionality anywhere, really, and not by psychologists or philosophers, for that matter. And it's just such a vital concept to be of any use to us.
We've been lost behind, because if you ask people theoretically, they would say that, for example, science is entirely the art of the provisional. There are no firm conclusions. They're all provisionally accepted until they're later disproved. And so it's accepted that it is a process of provisionality. And people will immediately say, you misunderstand. Science is like that, and so on. But in my experience, science is not like that, actually, because it's not very happy to examine its premises or to deliberately broaden its ways of conceiving things. And as a result, it gets narrower and less open to new ideas than it was. And if it's to be good science, which after all is just knowledge about the experiential world, it needs to be less dogmatic, more progressive in its attitude. And that's where I would pick up what you said earlier. You said psychologically, because there's a difference between, you know, pointing to your system and saying, my system is one of provisionality, but your mentality is one of rigidity.
Yep, quite, yeah. So that's obviously where the underlying philosophy and the psychology need to be brought together much more than they tend to be at the moment. And provisionality recognized as a psychological state. Whereas if you talk to a lot of secularists and naturalists and so on, then very often they say, oh, of course, it's all provisional, but it's just lip service. It's just a word that they attach to their beliefs without really considering what that word means or what it implies, or what practices are involved in being provisional or continuing to be provisional.
Would you like to expand on that? Because it sounds interesting.
Well, that's where I think there's this big connection with what is sometimes called spiritual practices, but they might also be seen as intellectual practices. But so I think there's you could talk about a whole range of practices, including meditation, for a start, but you can also talk about critical thinking. You can also talk about the arts, particularly as ways of contributing in different ways to integration and to the maintenance of provisionality, which enables integration.
I would agree with every part of that. And indeed, already there are good signs in psychiatry that methodologies such as mindfulness or practice of mindfulness, which is, as you know, derives from Buddhist spiritual practices, and CBT, you know, good old cognitive behavioral therapy, it's all there in Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, you know. what we're doing is rediscovering ancient wisdoms as we find the narrowness of our current perspective not satisfactory, and these are tools with which to shift. So I would agree. People are less open to the arts. I mean, it's become a sort of ghetto area, really, not integrated into life.
It is
a method. When I was a practicing psychiatrist, which I haven't been now for a year or two, many of my most valued colleagues were therapists who worked with drama, art, sculpture, and music. And much as people think, oh, well, you know, that's all very well, actually produced phenomenal results that weren't possible by using more verbal and rational techniques.
Yeah, that's interesting, yes. And as I understand it also, I mean, CBT has branched more into emotional and expressive areas, hasn't it? Or, you know, it's evolved so as to include that more. Yeah.
And of course, there are many variants on CBT, so, but yes. Mm. I was struck very much recently because I don't know that it's come out yet, but I was sent to review a book by Jonathan Glover called Alien Landscapes, which was about the mental world of people with psychiatric illnesses. But one, I won't say much about the book, but the one thing that came up in it was that he'd done extensive interviews with psychopathic individuals at Broadmoor who are notoriously difficult to reach. And there was an experiment called Shakespeare and Broadmoor where the RSC went and put on plays. And somehow these very difficult to reach people who couldn't be emotionally or cognitively reasoned with or rationally touched were somehow, perhaps not forever transformed, that would be too much to ask, but they were reached in ways that had consequences through watching Shakespeare, which struck me as quite remarkable, actually.
Hmm. Okay. And would it be useful perhaps to go back to power then, since we sort of left that on one side for the moment?
Yes.
Yeah. I suppose that the reason why I brought up power here was the that I'm very struck by the relationship between power and dogma, and that at least my understanding of how metaphysics has dogmatic effects is that it involves a kind of repressive mode or repressive mechanism. So I'd be very interested to get your perspective on whether you think that works in your experience. But I suppose that some of the my understanding of this has come via psychoanalysis and Jung and that kind of tradition, the idea that if we have a particularly strong representation, one of the effects of that can be to make alternatives unconscious. So we block them off in some way. So it seems to me that must be one of the ways in which dogma works, that it prevents us gaining access to alternative perspectives, even though those alternative perspectives may be there in the mind, or at least in the unconscious mind in some respect.
Well, indeed, and dogma is, in a way, by definition, exclusive, and to that extent is going to cut us off from alternatives. And I suppose that the structures of power are those which limit the alternatives for those that one wants to have power over. Yeah. I mean, I've seen such dogmatic ways of thinking emerging. I try to describe this in the case of, well, particularly the later Roman, later Roman Empire, but also towards the end of Hellenism and again towards the end of the Middle Ages, really, where dogmatism thrived and hierarchical structures which bore no, would not tolerate disagreement or dissent, seemed to flourish. And actually, I'm sorry to talk about what I've been reading, but I've also been reading a book which is extremely interesting called The Blunders of Our Governments, which has just come out, because I'm interested in why we make such extraordinarily crass decisions. And a lot of the time this was due to the fact that nobody felt able to be a dissenting voice in any of the structures. So these structures assumed that certain outcomes had to be made and that the rationale for them was a given, and it was simply a question then of cranking up the machine to make it happen. And you know, nothing could be more valuable to anybody who wants to be a wise governor than to have voices of dissent all around that he or she is going to listen to, and that doesn't seem to have been the case. So yes, I mean, in my terms, in terms of the hemispheres, the left hemisphere's one of its main values is that of power and control, because, as I say, it's taken over the functions of grasp, manipulation, and domination, which is what is required if one is going to manipulate the world. One is going to seize one's prey, one is going to build structures and so forth. In a benign way, this is control and power over the environment, but of course, control and power can be used for benign or non-benign ends. The right hemisphere's agenda is much less about power and much more about looking out for the things that might disrupt this. And then again, I'm reminded here of another wonderful book, Anti-Fragile, by Taleb, where the structures of control don't take into account things or properly weight things that are actually unpredictable, which will cause the whole thing to collapse. And if the structure were more provisional, or as he says, anti-fragile, it had built into it the need to change, the knowledge that this is only provisional, it will then actually survive on change and shock and danger, whereas a rigid dogmatic structure will collapse and go into crisis mode.
Yeah.
Does any of that ring bells with you, or am I way off
target? Oh, definitely. Yes. Yes. I've read Taleb recently too, and I mean, it certainly fits into the picture. I suppose what strikes me about this most, though, is that people often recognise power as an issue at a social political level, and then possibly they recognise it at a psychological level. But it seems relatively rare for people to fit the two together. You know, if you're repressing politically at the same time, it seems to me that we must be repressing potential representation psychologically. It's kind of the macrocosm reflecting the microcosm, that kind of pattern of interaction.
Definitely, and of course, one automatically thinks of government, but I think that may be a problem, of course, always is, but I think increasingly it's a problem through powerful technological forces, capitalist forces, behind enormous organizations such as Google, Facebook, and so on, which govern so much of what we experience, and are, in the way in which they're developing technology, frighteningly able to close down our experiences and our thinking. Yeah. I mean, they would deny that. But again, I've just been reading, again in proof, a book by Nicholas Carr, who's the man who wrote The Shallows, in which he's expanding on this topic at great length and in very cogently and very frighteningly. So I think we need to think about... I mean, what is absolutely extraordinary to me is how there exist people, but there are plenty of them, who think it's unproblematically obvious that it's a good idea to increase our capability to do something faster and faster and more unreflectingly. And if, given how dangerous many of the things we have done have been and how little we understand and see, it would surely be much, much better to slow down and limit our powers to intervene. And I know that sounds terrible because, of course, what about all these wonderful inventions that help people out of poverty and limit illness and so forth? But that is right. But an unreflective and, you know, there's no debate about where this is going. And unfortunately, it's running away, I think.
Mm. But I suppose it's our judgments need to be slowed down as much as possible, don't they? Not necessarily the execution of the judgments once we've made them. But
also time for experience. And one of the things that technology is threatening to do is to divorce us more and more from embodied experience, to substitute virtuality, mind maps and information for things that we learn through embodied interaction with the world. More and more of it will indeed be projections and representations, which is what the left hemisphere's world is essentially. And if one had to be very quick and dirty, it is a map of the world. It's not like the world. And these maps of the world through smart glasses and GPS systems and no doubt in the future implanted chips will give us so much information and intervene between ourselves and the world that one will have to ask, what's going on here? What is the point of human existence? good old questions come back with enormous urgency at the moment. Is it just to be able to do faster and faster the very trivial things that seem to be in the minds of most of the people who make these things possible? Mm-hmm. So that's where I find power worrying. But of course, also the gathering of information, famously knowledge is power, and the gathering of information on a vast scale, it's very hard to see how this cannot be implemented for ill by crooks and governments that we don't now necessarily foresee.
But so, can't we separate information from judgment to some extent? You know, if the key thing is that we're making over hasty judgments on the basis of a representation of the world that we're taking for granted, I agree that's a big problem. But surely information itself, if we learn to deal with that information and not to... Well, you know, Taleb talks about this a lot, doesn't he? That the way in which more information doesn't actually give us more useful information. But nevertheless, if we know how to use it, we can sift the information in a way that's useful to us and can be, you know, judged in an appropriate way.
Well, I'd say two things about that. One is that the more information you have, the harder it is to locate the important information, which is a common problem for repressive regimes when they're engaged in surveillance. But probably more importantly is that some kinds of information drive out others. So although it may be possible to access all kinds of information through smart glasses that will tell you where you can get the nearest Starbucks coffee and other things that are of commercial interest to Google's partners, it drives out the information that comes from quiet experience without technology listening to the world. Yeah. And, you know, that may sound, I hope it doesn't, but to some people that may sound terribly old-fashioned and idealistic or something, but actually it's completely essential to the experience of being a human being, to be as still and receptive as possible. And all these things are about more action and being in a constantly stimulated and active mode. I simply can't think of anything more degrading to the experience of being a human being than that.
Well, it's tough, isn't it, to find any kind of balance in that world, you know, that obviously, well, I suppose as we're all probably trying to do to some extent using that world, you know, we're talking on Skype now, we're using the internet to have this conversation.
I have my computer, I have it.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to find some balance in the way we use it, don't we?
Well, indeed. And that takes a lot of discipline. Mm. And it means being rather selective about how much of it you have, how much of it at the time you use it, and finding peace and silence and lack of stimulation and learning to learn from that and to be physically active in the world, you know, to go out and walk and you know, garden and do these other things. These things are kinds of information about the world. Interacting with real people is also information about the world, which is driven out by information through Facebook. I'm not saying that doesn't give information, but what we don't seem clear on, and this goes to the root of knowledge, is that one kind of knowledge can drive out another, and that one kind of awareness can make one unaware of others. It comes down again to the lack of provisionality, the sense that this is how things are because we've got experience of it and we know it. But we're not always saying, but what's the downside? What are we missing by hardening up on this thing that we value so much?
Yeah.
Perhaps it's not surprising in that case that we come across dogma so often on the internet that it's become part of the currency of the internet, hasn't it?
It is sad, isn't it? Because the internet could be a marvelous place for intelligent conversation, but it's a common place that it becomes a place for rants and unpleasantness, unintelligent interjects. Except, of course, on your blog.
Well, thank you both for a really fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Barry. And thank you very much, Rob. Good to see you.
Great.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy
at www.middlewaysociety.org.